Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Big Book Group, Alcoholics Anonymous, in Bellflower, which I think is the best group of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. And if you don't feel that way about your group, you better get busy in it. I'm glad to be here. I'd like to thank the committee, before I forget, for inviting me. I've always considered it a privilege to be allowed to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous in any capacity that I'm allowed to participate in. And I consider it an extreme privilege to be allowed to come somewhere I've always wanted to come to. I'm extremely pleased to be here tonight fully clothed and in my right mind. I know that really doesn't do a lot for you, but I really don't say it to do anything to you. You see, the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. And I never want to forget that a little over 24 years ago right now, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement at a maximum security penitentiary. And because of a loving God, as he expressed himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. And if I didn't get anything out of this deal at all, I could live with that all the way home. It just makes me feel good. If I made it tonight, I'd like to tell you how I got to where I was 24 years ago. I worked at it. You just don't show up there someday and say, let me in, coach. This is what I'm training for. I won't end up at 27 years old crawling around on the concrete floor in a pair of long-handled underwear barking at the moon. No, that's not what I wanted to do. What I was doing crawling around on that floor in a cell in solitary confinement a long, long time ago, I was looking for something. And to make matters even worse, I didn't know what it was I was looking for. But whatever it was, I didn't have it. Now, that's something I've always known. As far back as I could ever possibly remember, I've always known there was something the matter with me. I didn't know what it was. There was just something seemed to be missing. I didn't feel like they felt. And I didn't like them very much. And they seemed to know something that I didn't know. And I didn't belong around them very much. And you know who they are, don't you? They're the reason we're in here. And if you don't know who they are, you probably belong in Al-Anon. You know, I'd love to be able to stand right here tonight and tell you that where I was 24 years ago, that's where alcohol and drugs took me. Oh, I'd love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me. Alcohol and drugs didn't have anything to do with where I ended up. The only thing that alcohol did in my life, it kept me alive long enough to find you. Because I'm just as sure as I'm standing here tonight without alcohol wherever in my life, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 10 years old. Because I was just gone out there. I don't understand it. But I didn't seem to fit anywhere. I didn't understand. I kept looking for reasons why I felt the way I felt in here. And I had a built-in excuse for a long time. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said to myself, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. So I thought, well, I'll go out and find out where I belong. And I looked around to find out where I belonged. And one fun time, my eyes fell upon my grandmother, who was a kindly old lady, who lived till she was almost 90 years old, never took a drink of alcohol or smoked a cigarette in her life. Now, my grandmother prayed a great deal, and my grandmother went to church a great deal. And I had some kind of an idea in the back of my head, if I could just go where my grandmother went, I'd be okay. If I could just leave these people that I felt different and strange and irritable and hated, if I just leave these people and go around these good people, I'd be okay. So one day my grandmother said she'd take me where she went. And on Sunday one day, a long time ago, my grandmother took me to church. And I remember how excited I was about going to church with my grandmother because I knew it was all over now. I was going to go in there and sit down and be okay. I went over and I sat down around the good people and I felt different and strange and irritable and I hated everybody in the room. I said, I wonder what's the matter with me. I feel this way around the bad people. I feel this way around the good people. I wonder what's wrong with me. And I sat in a church a long, long time ago, and I did something that I did most of my life up into and including coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat there and waited for one of them quote and unquote superior people to tell me what was the matter with me. I sat there a long time ago in a church. I had a hole inside of me I didn't understand. I was different. I was trained. I didn't belong anywhere in the world. I waited for this man to get up at that rostrum that morning and tell me why I felt that way. And even more importantly than that, I wanted to tell me what to do about it. And I remember very vividly what the man said. He said, "You're supposed to love and honor and respect your parents." He said, "You're supposed to love your brothers." And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand, and I felt guilty about that. I became frightened to death sitting in the church that people were going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. I got up to walk outside the door of the church that day. My old man standing there drunk and hungover reached over and tapped me on the head and said, "Son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me." There was an awful lot of things in life I wanted to be, but my old man wasn't one of them. Because I hated him. See, my old man was a drunk. And I lived in a house where there were two drunks working. If you haven't lived in a nightmare like that, I'd like to explain it to you. In a house like that, in the middle of the night, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture and deathly silence. Every once in a while, the old man comes, drug me out of bed and started kicking me around. Now, I never did it to my brothers, he just did it to me. I can remember laying there in the middle of the night as a child, frightened to death because he's out there somewhere and wondering what's going on. I don't understand anything. But put my uncles in those penitentiaries and my aunts in those houses on the other side of the tracks. I make my old man beat up my mother beat up my old man. I don't understand any of those things. And somewhere way back in the middle of the night, it dawned upon me what the problem was. It's alcohol. That's the problem. They drink, I'm not going to. I'm going to step out in that world, and I'm going to have something, and I'm going to do something, and I'm going to be something. But what do you do if you're weird? You've been everywhere there is to go, and you've asked all the questions there is to ask. Say, what I did, I took a drink. It wasn't any big decision on my part. I just took a drink of alcohol. It was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. Because it just went down in there and just tore the madness from me. That's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol took me from the black pit of nothingness and stood me onto the gray fringes of the business of living and installed in me some type of arrogance and said, "Damn you, world, it's all right. Maybe I'm not good enough to be around the good people. Maybe I'm too good to be around the bad people, but it's okay right here." That's what alcohol did for me. Now, I'm going to tell you a strange secret. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. And the reason I don't drink alcohol anymore is because it don't work. It quit working a long time before I knew it quit working. I'd like to tell you that during my 20-year period of drinking, I discovered some wonderful way to drink alcohol. I never did. I'm a bad drinker. Well, I'm a hog. Hogs don't drink well. I'm one of them type of people think when one would do it, what would 35 do for you? I think that way. I don't know why it is, and everybody doesn't think that way. I remember one night I was in a meeting, my sponsor come running in there, and he said, "I got a headache." So being like a good baby, I ran around and got him two Excedrins. Ran up to him and stuck his hand out, put two Excedrins in his hand. He said, "We want one." I said, "Take two. You won't have a headache tomorrow." He didn't think that was funny. I was flopping around the floor. I thought it was hilarious. The way I think about it. I don't know why it is. I remember my first drink of alcohol. I thought to myself, "My God, I'm like my old man." And from that day until the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, a little over 20 years later, I never took a drink of alcohol willingly in my life. I never took it because I liked the way it tasted. And I never took it because it was a socially acceptable thing to do. I took it for one reason only. When it went down in there, it did something. And that's why I drank. My first drink of alcohol, I got drunk. 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath a bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. I was taken out of reform school by my mother and taken to California. On the way to California, my mother said, "Kid, we get to California, things are going to be different." They were. We left a one-room shack in Kansas, went to California, got a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mother got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went out on the street corner and got drunk. And I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing I'd ever found in my life up to that period that ever did the same thing twice in succession. I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground and having them come kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated doing. It went down in there and tore that madness and took me from there and stood me there and it gave me that. And I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. That's the story of my life. I got drunk and went places. I spent the next 3.5 years in a running court battle with my mother, a lawyer, and a judge. And once a month it went like this. My mother came to juvenile hall to visit me. She said, I love you and I miss you, and when you come home, things are going to be different. Once a month we went in front of a judge. He sent me to Whittier State Reform School. My mother stood up with a lawyer and appealed it. Once a month she came to visit me. She said, I love you and I miss you, when you come home, things are going to be different. Now, for a long time, I didn't buy that. For a long time, I'm keeping her out there and I'm keeping them away because I don't want to be hurt anymore. I don't want to get to believe in those things and get disillusioned. But see, I wanted so desperately to believe that the answer was out there somewhere. I wanted so desperately to believe that the answer was out there in a little white house with a picket fence, my mother with an apron with a tray full of cookies and milk. I wanted so desperately to believe that. And the reason I wanted so desperately to believe that the answer was out there, because if the answer is out there somewhere, I don't ever have to change. I can just do anything I want to and just show up, it's going to be fine someday. So somewhere during that 3.5 year period of time, I switched over and started to believe my mother, because I wanted so desperately to believe my mother. At the end of that 3.5 years, I went in front of a judge and he put me in a boys' home in San Fernando Valley. When I got there, the superintendent said if I was a good kid, I could go home on a home trip. Thank God I was good. 30 days came and went, and he put us on an old truck, and he brought us out of the valley, and it was an all-day trip, and he dropped us off in downtown Hollywood. I had to run to catch the old subway cars right downtown L.A., and I had to catch another streetcar right off the Willowbrook where I lived to get off of that to run a mile and a half to my mother's house. I remember like it was yesterday. How excited I was. It's all over now. No more differences, Ann. No more part-time. It's going to be fine now. I got to my mother's house. There was a drunken party going on there. Nothing changed, except me. I spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I'd heard a lot of strange things. I'd heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody to care for me used to tell me because that's a weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter because the minute you do that, they come along and kick you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe that because there was something down inside of me that said that's not true. But I walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself that I lived to be 500 years old. I'd never show anybody any human emotions again. And I went on the street corner and got drunk. I come home next month and got drunk again. Along about that time in my life, I was a periodic. Well, I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. It's always the same thing. I'd come home for a brick to a woman, get a bottle of Monte Carlo red wine, and get drunk and go back to school. And my first week in school was fine. I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. And my second week in school was fine. I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. My third week, the madness hit, and I started to think. I started to think about showing up in the neighborhood. I started thinking about walking up to my gang. My gang wanted me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what my gang would say if I was telling them I didn't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an architect, or an engineer. I wonder what they'd say. I wonder what they would say if I was to tell them I didn't want to go out and hit people in the head, I wanted to go play baseball. I wonder what they would say. But you see, if you're like me, and you're nothing, and you're glued over there against the corner of the wall, you're trying to figure out what is that magic thing that frees you from that nothingness and stands you out there and gives you that. And you think about that, and finally the answer comes. It's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. And you think about that, and you could just wait until you cap the seal and pour it down and make that magic come. One day I sit down in the street corner with a gallon of wine. I've been dreaming about that thing. I turned it up. I drank the whole gallon. I'm sober as I am right now. Frightened to death. My magic wasn't magic anymore. I didn't know what to do about that. The guy came along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, try these. And he gave me some pills. I found out if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. Wasn't very much longer after sitting on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine. Nothing was working. And the guy came along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, try this. And he gave me some morphine. I found if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of things that sustained me for the next 14 years of my life. It was never one or two, it was a combination of all of them. I became too old to stay in that school. I came out of my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. But I had a problem. I didn't stand up too often. That's not conducive for being a gangster. You got to look alert when you're out there doing anything. You can't run and say, stick them up and puke on somebody. It really doesn't have a ring of machoism about it. You don't gather up in my neighborhood and talk about puking. You gather up in my neighborhood and talk about being tough. And the reason you gather up in my neighborhood and talk about being tough is because you're scared to death somebody's going to find out you're not. And that's the way we lived in my neighborhood. We live like that where I lived. I lived out in the streets. I don't know where you live, but I live in the streets. And when you live in the street and you're a street person, All you do is live in a lie of busted dreams and fantasies and falsehoods because you're always trying to prove that you measure up. You see, I never did. I never measured up anywhere. I spent 20 years of my life looking for lower companions, and I never found them. By the time I always got there, I was less than. And if you're like me, and I don't know whether you're ever like me or not, because, you see, no matter where I was, I always had to do twice as much just to almost fit in. No matter what it was, I was an overachiever just to almost belong because I didn't belong. No matter what I did, I didn't do enough to belong. And where I lived, out in the street, you got to do a lot of things you don't want to do, and I used to do them. Because I only lived with one thought or two thoughts in my life, all of my life, from my first drink to my last, of this: either get the money to get loaded on or get loaded, period. And I was willing to pay any price, suffer any kind of consequences, do anything to anybody to achieve those two goals. And heaven help you or anybody that got between me and the thing that I wanted. You see, that's the way takers live. That's the way takers of things and abusers of people think. And you see, I'm an alcoholic. That makes me a taker of things and abuser of people. And that's the way I live. And when you live that way in the streets, you go to jail a great deal. Because there isn't much choice in there. They just come and get you. And you're always guilty. You ever saw an alcoholic that wasn't guilty? But I was born guilty and kept getting worse. I remember when I first come into AA, I used to stand in the door shaking people's hands, and they'd come along and spill coffee on me. I'd say, "Excuse me." And that's what I think. But that's the way I felt all my life. I tried real hard to be a gangster, and I failed. Because I was a never-was. You know what a never-was was? A never-was is something that's so frightened of failing, he doesn't try to do anything. He just sits around wherever he's at, in his jailhouse, his penthouse, his nut house, his hotel room, and says to himself, "Tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to get up off of this floor. Tomorrow I'm going to step out in that world. Tomorrow I'm going to do all them things. Tomorrow I'm going to show those people. Tomorrow. Tomorrow I woke up sick. Tomorrow I had to get well." And the only thing that broke that cycle of life up for me was when I got arrested and went to jail. And went on and on and on. I even got arrested once and sent to the United States Army. Well, my mother wanted me to go in the Army. I wanted to go to jail. But Mom didn't want me to put a mark on the family's good name or something. A lot of fixation my mother had. I'll tell you, the only thing I can tell you about the Army was that where I had my first spiritual experience. It was in a guardhouse in Fort Lewis, Washington, in a thunderstorm. I remember it dawned upon me the lack of power was my dilemma. But see, I thought power came in a money clip. I thought if you had enough power, nobody could bother you. So I came out of the Army and accumulated power. I got all of the things that society says is power. I got a big automobile. I got me a big apartment building. I moved into the top floor. I got me a closet full of $300 suits. A lot of money in my pocket. People are coming around at all hours of the night and begging a big man for a favor. And every once in a while, the big man would grant him a favor. The only problem was I couldn't leave the apartment. Because every time I did, they jumped on me and took me to jail. Every once in a while, I used to get brave. I'd sneak out of my big apartment in one of my new suits, and I'd get my big automobile, and I'm driving around the streets, and I've got nobody around to impress about what a big man I am, and I'm not too impressed with me anyhow. So I'm driving up alongside of people in those beat-up pickup trucks, and I'm saying to myself, why can't I be like this guy? Why can't I just go to work and have a wife and a couple of kids like my brother? My God, what's the matter with me? What's the matter with me? You see, I don't know at that time that I've run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions to blame for my dilemma. But I still had a kicker. The kicker that kept me from going absolutely and totally and permanently insane was my ability to blame something other than myself for my actions. And my last bastion of blame was God. His fault. He don't like me. The God my grandmother talked about when I was a little boy, who punished the little boys who were bad, who'd been kicking me around since I could remember. Every once in a while I hear that in AA. I guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot it down here to the club. I'll tell you how I feel about that. the next time you get hungry, go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. You want to come squirting through the keyhole, call me. I've been living for a deal like that all my life. They told me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you want a garden, you better get you a hoe. That's the truth. There ain't no free rides here, folks. You get out of this thing and just what you put into it, you don't get anything out. 1951, I'm on my way to the penitentiary, and life's just about over for me. I don't know that. I'm laying in the old Los Angeles County Jail. My mother comes to visit me, and she screams at me through the visit, and screams that I'm a murderer. It seems that my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison and taken an overdose of it and died. I didn't know how to handle that very well. I handled like I handled most things. I got angry at it and made it go away. 3 days later, I'm handcuffed between two detectives out underneath a tree while they bury my baby brother. Now, I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging around me, and I'm trying to cry, and I don't know how. I don't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth, and the reason I don't have them is because I don't think they're necessary. I went on to the penitentiary, and I stayed there 4 years. I came out of there 4.5 years sicker than I was when I went in there. I spent the next couple of years of my life trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me it wasn't true. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. He says, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me down and showed me a little green room and said, you're going to end up here, hot shot. And I told him, not me, I'm different. Up on walls, now that institution bound determined I had that deal beaten. 6 months later, I'm laying in a nut house, kicking and screaming. That's when I made my round to some of the better laughing academies in the world, interviewing psychiatrists. That's what I used to do. I used to sit there with my wraparound overcoat on and talk. They talk to me about my mother. I talk to them about their mother. And they my mother. Then they took me on wild music sound. Oh, that'll get your attention. Then after they reduced me to a state of childishness, one more time, I sit across the table from the doctors. I still got the same feelings inside of me I had sitting at my grandmother's knee in church 20 years before that. I'm still frightened. I'm still lonely. I'm still guilty. I don't belong anywhere in the world. I don't know what's the matter with me. I think I'm absolutely and totally and permanently insane. Only now I've got a bigger problem. Now I am really in trouble because the things I used to put in here to make that livable were no longer working. That no matter what I put inside of me, I couldn't make me go away anymore. I couldn't turn off the nightmares and the pictures, and I'm really in trouble. And now what the doctor said to me, Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problems. I couldn't make him understand that that wasn't my problem. As sick as I was, I knew that wasn't the problem. See, my problem was I was nothing. I was always nothing. I came from nothing. I was nothing. I was going to be nothing always. I used to put something in me, I became almost. See, to a nothing, almost is top of the world. And here's a guy trying to tell me who's supposed to know that the thing I put in me to make me an almost is a problem when I know the problem is I'm a nothing. Now that don't work. So I came back to town, but I don't know to do what. And 25 years ago, the first part of this year, I ended up in the old Los Angeles County Jail, strapped down on a bed. I weighed 128 pounds, and I was yellow. They had my left arm and my right leg tied down, and there was a medical doctor standing at the foot of my bed telling me I was going to die before morning. He said, son, you're going to die, and nothing I can do for you. I said, okay. He left, and all day passed, and all night passed. He came back in my room, looked down. He said, son, you're going to die, and nothing I can do for you. I said, okay. The third day he got ready to come into my room, I had a terror grip me that I've never known before or since. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again. And God knows I didn't want to do that. So I laid in that bed for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't need food, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. And I thought for a long, long time nothing happened because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts. And they got an A meeting down there. Little bird didn't come in and drop the fifth chapter on my chest, and I didn't get up and wander off into the tulips. I just went to sleep for a little while. And I started to get better and better and better and better. You know, I've had 25 years plus to look back upon that deathbed of mine. And I know exactly what took place in that bed. The thing died, and I woke up. Because my life has been different from that day to this day. Basically, what was different was my attitude. Because when I got up off that bed, it was no longer necessary for me to be hip-flip, keen, and cool anymore. I just was tired of packing around all them sick images of mine that I didn't understand, trying to be something to a lot of people I thoroughly hated that I didn't want to be in the first place. Shortly thereafter, I'm standing in front of a Superior Court judge being sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. That doesn't mean anything to me. That's the game I played. You win some, you lose some. As I turned to walk out of the courtroom that day, the judge changed his conversation from me to a lady who was sitting in the courtroom. And what he said to her was the most damning piece of evidence anybody ever presented about me in my life. He said to her, "Lady, if you care anything at all about the child you carry inside of you, you'll get so far away from this scum, you'll never be allowed to lay eyes on it. He's a blood-sucking parasite in society. He doesn't have any right being around decent people. If it's in my power, he's never going to be." And I'm walking out of the courtroom, and he's not talking about me. That must be my old man, or my uncles, or my grandfather, or somebody. But he was talking about me. I knew he was talking about me. He put into words what I spent a lifetime trying to hide from the world. What I really, really was in here. Not what I put up out there, but what I am in here. That's the magic that used to be put to sleep, or the madness that no longer engulfed me when I put something inside of me that made it go to sleep. The evidence of that statement was so damning, I spent the next 9 months of my life locked up in solitary confinement. And that's the way I was when I stumbled into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 23 years ago, come the first Sunday in November. Now, I don't take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I'd have known where I was coming 23 years ago, I wouldn't even have come. I wasn't even alcoholic. You see what you've made me? The reason I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is because the institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 20, almost 23 years ago now, to smell perfume. I've been honking and sniffing around ever since. You got to be careful with just the sick people in here. Now, I don't take any credit for that, really. Nor do I take any credit for staying there from that day to this day. None at all. I remember my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I pray God I don't ever forget this, because if I ever forget it, I'm condemned to relive it. I remember moving in and sitting down in the back row on what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on, because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have froze to death. I remember looking up on the backboard and seeing two big eggs, and I thought to myself, my God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. I said to this clown sitting next to me, "What is this?" He said, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I sat down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If it'd been Gangsters Anonymous or Over Hip Anonymous or Weirdos Anonymous, I'd have been waving at them. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what one was, but I didn't want to be one. I said, "Well, I better not wait for the women to tell their racy stories." And they got up and they threw me a curve, because they had sort of a twinkle in their eye and a smile on their face, and they sort of radiated something I didn't understand. Right away, they learned it, they started talking about God. And when I came here and you talked to me about God, I got up and ran out of the room, because God was the reason I was. I kept coming back to your meetings because I'd seen you. And seeing you, I had seen the miracle. I didn't know that. But seeing you, I had seen the miracle. So I kept coming back. There you'd be standing, twinkling in the eyes and smiles on your faces, talking about God. I kept leaving. I used to think about you a great deal. All week long, I think about you, about them crazy people who drove 185 miles to that penitentiary every week to sparkle and smile. I didn't know what they said, didn't hear what they said. Every once in a while, I'd get one of those convicts and put him up against the wall, look in his eyes and say, "You don't have it," and turn around and walk off. You get a lot of comments in those places when you start doing stuff like that. I got up one Sunday morning a long, long, long time ago. I don't know what Sunday morning it was. I had no way of knowing it was the most important day that I'd ever lived. I had no way of knowing when I woke up that morning and took my shower and shaved and did all the things that I did, that that was the day I was going to be let out of hell. I didn't know that. Because if I'd have known that that was the day somebody was going to put the key into the gates of hell and let me out, I wouldn't have went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I don't want to over talk to the doctor or to the preacher or to the warden or to the counselor or to the parole officer or one of the guys in the domino tables or something. I was not conditioned to go to drunks ranchers. Thank God I didn't know that. But I did what I always did. I went over there and I sat out on my throne of contempt. A little guy that I knew did 23 fat years in the penitentiary stood at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and told me something I've never forgotten. It makes more sense to me than anything that I know. It'll make more sense to me tomorrow than anything I'll ever hear. He says, you just don't have to live this way no more if you don't want to. He says, you don't have to do it like this no more. Nobody ever told me that. They've been telling me all my life, don't drink, swallow, smoke, and shoot. But how do you live in a world that you don't belong to? That you don't fit in, that wants no part of you, and you don't want any part of, and the only thing that makes it bearable for an instant is when you put it in there. After the meeting, I ran up to this little guy. I said, how do you learn how to live? He looked at me and smiled, and he said, Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. If you go get it, I'll go home and pray if you find some part of you in that book. And I guess he's prayed really hard, that little fella, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I've ever found in that book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all the society's ill. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. Now I'm going to tell you about the strange phenomena that takes place in my life. It seems like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in that book, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship, just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. I fought Alcoholics Anonymous very hard when I came here, because I didn't think I could have Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to sit in meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd hear things I didn't understand. If people would come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they'd say, I used to drink, now I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful. I'd say, well, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. Because when I don't drink, all hell breaks loose. Then I'd hear that wonderful story. I drank up my wife and my business and my family and got sober. Got back my wife and my business, and then I got drunk. I drank up my wife and my business and my family, and then I got sober. And I said, now I know I'm not alcoholic. Because when I'm sober, all I do is think about getting drunk. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that. I couldn't equate the word alcohol with my problem. I didn't understand it. Sobriety was my enemy. It wasn't my friend. Sobriety is when the nightmare sets in. Sobriety is when the irritability and the discontent and the loneliness and the guilt and the remorse and the hatefulness engulf me. God, I got to drink. And these people are telling me they're different than I am because all they've done is just quit drinking. If that's all your problem is, alcohol, don't drink anymore. Period. That's the end of the conference. You don't even have to come to another meeting anymore. Now that you know what your problem is, don't do it. But you see, I don't have that problem. Because I'm crazy. And I didn't understand. I used to read that book. It didn't make any sense to me. I remember the first time I looked there, I thought, my God, this is a wonderful way. I found a way to get my mother sober. She had a problem, my mother. One Sunday she come to visit me, and I guess in all good sense she come to visit me, and she come to visit her son. And she's in this room, and she looked up, and there's a madman standing on the other side of the table screaming at the top of his voice, Mom, you got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and learn how to get sober. My mother left, and she didn't come back. I'm glad of that. I'm tickled to death about that. You see, the very nature of my illness, and I don't know about yours, the very nature of my illness made it necessary for me to run off every living thing that I had. The very nature of my illness made it necessary for me to destroy every dream or every illusion I ever had. The very nature of my illness tells me this evening that if I had anything left out there to blame for my dilemma, I'd still be out there blaming it. But stripped of all things and all choices, then and only then did I turn to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous where it's outlined in that book. And I found myself doing strange things. I found myself sitting down with a tablet and a pencil writing about things. I didn't understand that. Because I used to do things in alcoholics. I used to hear other things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've got to get active in A&A. And I used to think about that. And I used to look around for people who were active. We had one smiling secretary. This wonderful way we live is wonderful. Very. look around at the people who were active. We had one of them smiling secretary. This wonderful way we live is wonderful. Very sickening, this guy. Now, if you're hip, slick, keen, and cool, that's not very cool to be hip, slick, keen, and cool. And so I went up to him one day, and I said to him, I said, I hear you're supposed to be active around here. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, what can I do? He said, what? And I said, what can I do so nobody know I'm a member? He said, you really are sick, aren't you? And I said, no, I'm not. I said, I just don't want anybody to know that I'm a member of AA. You see, I had a bad problem. I wanted to be with you, but I didn't want to lose my status with them. See, I still wanted to be, you know, and sober. And it's awful hard to be hip and sober at the same time. You know, it's awful hard to live in a sick image in a well society. And I didn't want, see, I didn't want them to know that I was trying to get well. I mean, heaven forbid anybody would see you trying to get well. I mean, gosh, stay sick. So he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I don't know. What do you do? He said, well, I go get the guests on Sunday and bring them. I said, that's a good idea. Nobody will have to know I'm a member. They think I'm an escort service. He said, sure. I said, he said, come do it Sunday. I said, no. You do it Sunday. I'll see how it's done. You know, you don't want to blow a big thing like hello there. You know what I mean? You got to do it right if you're going to do it. You don't just jump into this action real quick. You got to look at all the options. So I watched him Sunday. He went down to the gate. Welcome to A&A. It's a wonderful way to live. Come join our happy program. And they followed him down there, and he poured their coffee and smiled at him, and God, it was sickening. He wasn't at all hip, slick, keen, and cool. And the next Sunday, I sallied forth. Now, you got to remember that this time in my life, I'm so hip that the balls of my feet tickle me when I walk. But I never look at anybody. I look up or down. I never look because I don't want them to know what's going on. And so I walk, and one day, it's a wonderful way to live. Come join our happy program. They wouldn't come in. And I looked at my friend and I said, what's the matter with him? He said, dummy, you have to smile at him. I said, what's that? He said, it's a frown turned upside down. You know, it wasn't much longer after that. I'm standing at the gate on Sunday. Welcome to A&A. It's a wonderful way to live. I'm going to happy soul down. I took him down there and poured the coffee, smiled at him, went back and sat in the corner and died. I was doing everything he told me to do. I was running around like a chick with my head cut off. And I still had all the things that I always had. I didn't understand it. I was still crazy. I was still lonely. I was still apart from. No matter what you told me to do, I was not a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was apart from this. I didn't belong. I didn't think I belonged. I had gone too far. You weren't like me. I was different than you were. And I was doing what you told me to do, and I didn't get happy. I read this dumb book, and it didn't make any sense. One day I threw it across the room and looked down and saw the most simple statement I've ever seen in my life. I said, how it works. I want you to know I almost missed that. Down where I live, we read it at every meeting. You know, if you ever read the fifth chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, if you ever read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, the longer you read it and the more you study it, the more the mysteries get cleared up. There's no mystery to me tonight about who makes our fellowship and who doesn't and why not. In the preamble of the fifth chapter from our book Alcoholics Anonymous, the statement is this: rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Period. Well, it takes a lot of mystery about slipping around there, don't it? It takes a lot of mystery about a lot of things, about why they leave and why they don't stay, why some folks stay here and get happy and contented and joyous and free and live forever and ever and ever, ain't they? I found myself doing what it said to do in this book. I found myself writing out inventory. I found myself sitting down with a man, spending 3.5 hours telling about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. I walked out of the man's office and sat down, and about this time of the year, I felt the green grass under my hand. I heard the birds singing, and I was free in the world. I've been free ever since. Freedom ain't got nothing to do with where you're at. I'm free. I'm still free. I've been free ever since. The great miracle of my life took place the following night when I went to my Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I went over and I sat down at a meeting. The strange thing that happened to me as a result of doing those things, I was no longer a part from Alcoholics Anonymous. I had become a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. It had been my good fortune and my great pleasure to be allowed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings all over the North American continent from that day to this day. And wherever I was, if I didn't know where I was, I wouldn't know where I was. Because I'm always part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go anywhere and sit. I'm part of it. I guess it's because I've become willing to fulfill the conditions of a program of recovery. Not to just go through the motions of showing up. Strange things started to happen to me. Along about that time in my life, my vocabulary consisted of about four-letter words. Mother ran all around in there somewhere. It was kind of a trigger that made everything happen. One day I'm over there cutting a little dentist hair, and he said to me, "Johnny, if you ever get out of here, what are you going to do?" And I told him. He says, "You'll never make it." I said, "Why not?" He says, "The minute you open your mouth, they're going to know where you come from." I said, "What's the matter with my mouth?" He said, "Nothing. You just open it every now and then." And he said to me, "Do you know what cussing is?" And I said, "No. What is it?" He said, "It's a crutch for conversational cripples." And I said, "Oh." And then I heard me say something I'd never heard me say before. "What am I supposed to do about it, doctor?" "I don't know any other way to talk." He said, "If you're serious, I'll help you." And so for a period of time, the little doctor and three of his little friends set me in a room, and they word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, read me the English language. They loved me, these little guys. They didn't think I was cute, and they didn't tee-hee when I said some off-colored four-letter word. They said, "We don't say it that way, Johnny." And then they stood my wrath when I rained on them. And that takes love, folks. They wouldn't put up with my nonsense. They love me. Anybody that put up with your nonsense, if they put up with you, that's not love. The reason people put up with your nonsense is because they want to build up a little good time, so when they commit nonsense, you'll put up with them. These people didn't have any nonsense to commit, so they weren't trying to impress me with anything. 21 years ago, come the 4th of June, I walked out of that penitentiary. Went home to see my mother. She fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch, said, "Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting." She said, "Fine, I think you should." Took my mother a long time to get out of all this now, but I'm very proud, and I tell you, when she's sober, she goes to meetings. Now, she don't stay sober very often, but that ain't any of my business. I learned the greatest lesson in life from my little mother. I learned I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk, either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober. Where would I get it? Where would I get any power? Have any power? Where would it come from? The book don't say that. The book says I'm given a daily reprieve, and that's contingent upon my maintenance of certain spiritual conditions. That's what that book said. I didn't say that. The book says that. That's the authority of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know what spiritual conditions mean to you. I tell what they mean to me. Because I can't do anything you can't watch. It's almost like having a pet parrot and giving it to the town gossip and not worrying. I'd like to tell you I live that way. And if you believe that, I got a bridge I want to sell you right after this meeting. One of the greatest things I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here. They told me I had to find a God of my very own. And I said, "Why?" He says, "Because we're human beings, and sooner or later we'll show you our feet of clay. All human beings have feet of clay. I don't care who they are. They'll all show you. You see, if I hadn't found a God of my very own when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, down through a period of years, all the people, my sponsor, my father in Alcoholics Anonymous, my mother in Alcoholics Anonymous, all the people that I've worshipped and loved all these years, if I had a God of my very own when they showed me their feet of clay, I'd have been dead. But I found out that they were human beings. One of the greatest things I've ever found out is people are human beings. And you know what? You can't love somebody that's not human. It's humanly impossible to love somebody that doesn't have a flaw. That doesn't mean that that's an excuse for being a jerk. You know, one of the greatest misused lines in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They say, well, we're not saints. You ought to read the next line. It says we grow along spiritual lines. That means we have to. It's amazing. It's amazing the things that I see and hear in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm close and active in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I hear a lot of things. I was in a meeting in San Diego last Saturday night. And a guy came up to me after the meeting and said, you make this thing sound awfully easy. I said, it is. He said, you make it sound so simple. I said, it is. He said, what's your greatest blessing? And I thought about that. And I said, my greatest blessing is that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have the word alcohol to use as an excuse for being a jerk. I can't do anything that I want to just because I'm sober. If I don't live a certain way, I'll be drunk before the week's out. I have to. But you see, it's no longer I have to. It's just the way I live. And you know, I haven't had a conscious desire or a thought to take a drink of alcohol or swallow anything chemical since the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not one. But that doesn't make me wonderful. That just means that I've focused my attention on the real problem since I've been here. Me. I'm the problem. You see? And I no longer live in the problem of alcohol. I live in the solution called Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a big difference. There's a big difference between being hung up on alcohol and living in the solution. That's what those drying out joints do. They deal in the problem. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we live in the solution. I'm not one of those people who said, I came here 25 years ago, put the plug in the jug, and I've been running to the street by and by forever and ever. Amen. If you know anybody like that, there's one of two things wrong with them. They're nutty in hell or they're taking something. They don't live where I live. I live out there with them. And they're still out there, those folks. And I don't understand them any better today than they did 25 years ago, but thank God I know that. Thank God I know I'm not like other people. The book Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me well that I had to destroy the idea that I would ever be like other people. The delusion that I'm like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. That's what the book says. I don't say that. The book says it. We spend so much time worrying about what the people say. We ought to find out what the book says. People only give their own interpretations of whatever suits them. Me and everybody else. You see, I could stand here all night long and justify my way of living. I could tell you about all the screwy things that I do. And I could justify that very easily by saying, but I didn't drink. Does that excuse me for being a jerk? For being a living ass out there somewhere? For being inconsiderate and kind and hateful and disillusionment, to being a bad example of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, is it really a good excuse for running around the world and saying just because you're sober and you're a wonderful example of Alcoholics Anonymous, you do everything you want to do? There's people out there watching. You don't ever know who's looking at you. Yeah. Scary. I'll tell you, the worst time I've ever lived in my life, Alcoholics Anonymous, I lived sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've experienced more pain sober than I ever experienced loaded. And the reason for that is because I never allowed myself to experience pain prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. My 7th year of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous almost drove me crazy. I didn't understand what went on. But yet I really do understand what went on because I accumulated a few things. I came enraptured with out there. I was trying to belong and fit into some place I'd never belonged. And I got all the things that you had, a big house and a couple of cars, a lovely wife and a couple of little kids. And all those things are gone, and I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to institutions, and I'm doing all the things I'm supposed to do, but things ain't right. I'm going home from meetings and my wife's not there, and my little kids are the babysitters. I gotta go get them, and I gotta go around the bars to find her. Take her out of the bar and put her in the car and ask her questions like, why? If you got a drinking problem, let's go to Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, but I'm Al-Anon. And I don't say that to be delicious, but she thought she was Al-Anon because she was married to me. You're an Al-Anon member when you go to Al-Anon and practice the Al-Anon program. Just because your husband's sober and you show up with him doesn't make you a member of Al-Anon. If you don't believe that, ask some of them good Al-Anon members. I was corrected real quickly about that one night in the meeting by one of the authorities in Al-Anon. I once got up one day and I'd been through one of these things and I told this woman that I was married to, I couldn't live with her anymore. She didn't want to live my way and I obviously didn't want to live her way, and one of us was going to have to leave. It looked like it was going to be me. An hour later, they went to work, they came and got me and told me she committed suicide. I didn't live with that very well. I got very angry about it. I usually get angry at things. Makes them go away. You know what anger is? Anger is a wrong man's righteousness. That's what anger is. If I'm angry, I'm wrong. It doesn't make any difference what I'm angry about or who I'm angry at. If I'm angry, I'm wrong, because anger, and I don't know what it does for people in Canada. But for me in California, when I get angry, it elevates me into a position of judgment. So I can judge. And there's another book that says, judge ye not the righteous judgment, lest ye be judged. I wandered on out large and on with angry for a long time. One night I went to a meeting where my sponsor was talking, and I was angry there and I'm mad, and he talked about his wife and his kids and his job and all that, and I was getting ready to leave AA. I started to wander out the door that night, and my sponsor came and got me, put his arms around me, and he hugged me. He said, gee, Johnny, I guess God loves you a great deal. And I said, no, I don't think so. He says, yeah, he never gives any more than we can handle. Knows who's got the biggest load. Surely got to be the blessed. And I promptly told him I didn't want to be blessed anymore either. And then he says something I haven't figured out. He says, remember this, my friend. He gives big crosses to big horses. He gives little crosses to guys named John. I went home that night and tried to figure out how big my cross was. And I didn't have one, because I was sober. I lived a long time in the world, peaceful and joyous and free. Just because I've had a few cloudy days in my life doesn't mean the sun's not ever going to shine anymore. So I got down on my knees somewhere I hadn't been for a long time because I'd become too big to pray. And I said a little prayer in the same position I said it every day of my life since then. The prayer is this: God, relieve me of the bondage of self, and I may be a witness to those who see your undying mercy and love on me. I got up and it seemed like to me I've been walking toward the light ever since. Shortly thereafter, I'm walking to a 4th of July picnic in Long Beach, and a little blue-eyed angel gave me a piece of chicken. That's the most expensive piece of chicken I've ever eaten in my life. But it's the most rewarding meal I've ever eaten also, because it's necessary for my fulfillment in life. See, I believe only two things in life. I only believe two things. With the only two things that I believe in life. If I didn't believe them, I'd go get drunk right after this meeting. I believe that everything that's necessary for my fulfillment in life will be given to me. I believe that. And all that's required of me is that I have to practice the principle of this program in my life and give this thing away to anybody that wants it anytime they want it for free and for fun. I get no pay for it. I also believe that anything that's necessary that will hinder my fulfillment in life will be removed from me through no effort of my own, and all that's necessary for me to do is to fulfill the conditions of recovery of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and give this thing away to anybody who wants it for free and for fun. And the reason I can tell you that is because I've had almost 23 years to look back over and examine the evidence. Got a track record. I can look back and see it just as clear as I can see you. I can see that everything that would harm me or hurt me has been removed from me through no effort of my own. And all I've ever done is go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and be willing to do whatever I've been asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Firstly, I had to fulfill the conditions of this program of recovery, and then the 12 steps said, that's the message I carry. A lot of people got it all mixed up. They think they get sober and go out and sober up the world. The book don't say that. The book says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And when I'm running people down on the freeway, I don't know what step I'm practicing. And a lot of beautiful things have happened. You know that little kid, that little girl I've never supposed to see? She'd be 25 years old come September. I not only raised her, but I got to go to the hospital and watch her give birth to my two grandsons. I not only raised her and watched her give birth to my two grandsons, but I've had the great pleasure of having her bring them bandits by and let me take care of them. She brought little Jimmy by there one night on her way to a high school reunion, and I'm sitting in the house on Friday night. Daddy's got to go to a meeting because she's treasurer and needs me. She can't find a babysitter, so she said, I can't find a babysitter. I said, I'll take care of him. She said, you sure? I said, sure. Took care of you, didn't I? She said, not all the time, Dad. But anyhow, little Jim chased me, so I couldn't make it no more, so I jumped up in the bed and put the television set on. He chased the dogs, so they couldn't handle it no more, and they jumped up in bed and started watching television. Then he lay down on the floor and kicked himself to sleep. And I went over there and picked him up, and I put him on my chest and put my arms around him, and it dawned upon me at that instant where I was and what I was doing. I had defied my God. Through the vast miracle of alcoholics tonight, had defied all the odds of existence and all the great laws of society. Not only had I gotten to see the child I was never supposed to be able to see, I raised her. And not only, by the miracle of alcoholics tonight, in defiance of all the laws of society, not only did I raise her, I also have been given the great privilege to be allowed by enough respect from her to take care of her child. And I started to cry, and I was crying like that when they came home. And I cry when I think about that. Great defiance of all laws. By the miracle of God, through a miracle called Alcoholics Anonymous, all the laws of society have been defied in my life. Because there ain't any way I could get from where I was 24 years ago to where I am right now. Ain't no way you can do that. I remember one time I went up to talk in a meeting in San Jose. And there was a big old meeting, and what they do up there, they were in a big old hall, and they bring all these kids from these drug recovery houses out of there. And I move in, and I sit down in a chair over in the corner, and I get me a cup of coffee. And I'm sitting there, and some kid comes walking up there, and he was hippie. Hey, baby, and I said, yeah, we know he's hippie, he's dressed hip. You know, he got well, he's just dressed hip. You know what he's looking like when he's dressed hip. He says, you Johnny Harris? And I said, yeah. He said, you don't look like him. And I said, oh, what's he look like? He said, well, you know, man, I've been listening to your tape for 6 months. You know, you've been all in places and done all that stuff. And I said, well, if I talked out of the corner of my mouth, you'd mother every other word, had long hair and a beard, and drug my leg around here, would that fit it? He said, yeah. I said, you don't seem to understand, young man. I live by a program that's spiritual in nature when practice is a way of life evolves through all that garbage. He said, the hell you say? Turn around and walk out. And you never know. A few months later, I'm at a place in Reno, Nevada, an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I walk in on Saturday night, I get me a cup of coffee, and I sit down, look over in the front row, and there's that kid. Only it ain't that kid. He got his hair cut, he's got a clean shirt and a pair of slacks on. He stands up and sees me, he says. I walk over there, and he hugs me. Gives me a little kiss right here. And that's tough when you hit. What he said to me destroyed me. He said, I want you to know I live by the same spiritual program that you do. And I thought how easy in San Jose it had been for me to destroy him. All I would have had to do was get down with him. You know what I mean? Start talking that trash. Hey, that's me, baby, you know, and John from the penitentiary. You ever notice that? You ever notice out there in the world they say, hey, baby, come on, let's get down. How come they don't ever say, come on, let's get up? You know why? They don't want you up. People who are down don't want you up. Because if you stand up and you're down, you're a direct appliance that they can get up to if they will acquire and use the effort to go from there to here. What you got to do. It's amazing, this fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always considered being sober as a gift. I haven't done anything rewarded to get this gift. I haven't accumulated or accomplished anything since I've been here. I just show up every day of my life, and here I am. It's amazing. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an old lady by the name of Myrtle Snyder. I asked her about sobriety one time. I said, "What is this thing called sobriety?" She said, "A gift from God." I said, "Oh, what do I give God back? Because I don't owe God nothing." She said, "What you do with your sobriety would be your gift to God." Thought about that a long time. Everybody knows me, knows that I was laid off. 2 years ago, a company I worked for bought me a membership in a country club, and I'm out there playing golf one day with some doctors. And I'm walking down the fairway, I got a short sleeve shirt on. On my arms, I got things like daggers and skulls with blood dripping from them. Panthers with their sides shot out. They're real conversational pieces in the coffee shop. The doctor said to me, "Gee, Johnny, you sure have big forearms." And I said, "Sure do." He said, "You ever play baseball?" I said, "Sure. Every time I went to jail." He said, "Oh, you've never been in jail." And I didn't tell him any different. That ain't never been my deal. I used to be bad and I'm wonderful. But you're bad because you've never been bad. I've never been that sick. I never went out and flaunted my being well as an excuse for being sick. And I'm glad of that because this little doctor has become a great friend of mine. I love him very much. And I played golf with him about once a month. He moved to another country club. He said, "The clientele were a little better." Anyhow, he said to me one day, I was talking to him, he told me a story. He told me about he was a little orphan in New York, in Bronx. He was a Jewish guy, he was. He lived and studied and sacrificed. He did go down. He took himself out of the orphanage, and then he took himself and put himself into school and worked and he studied and sacrificed. And he did without, and he got through school. And then he worked and he studied and sacrificed. And he did without, and he became a doctor. And then he worked and studied and sacrificed and did without. He bought a house and joined the country club and he played golf on Wednesday. That's his deal. All his life he's done that. He worked and studied and sacrificed and he did without. He accomplished all that himself. How do I tell it? I spent my entire lifetime running up and down the streets, in and out of penitentiaries and nut houses, and I got sober and ended up the same place he did. He wouldn't believe me. He still doesn't believe me. And he really doesn't believe me. Because he thinks, like a lot of people that I know think, that life is a self-improvement program. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-improvement program. Alcoholics Anonymous is a miracle, a way of life given from God to people like me to show me that I don't have to live the way I used to live anymore. But all I got to do is try to live in the great image of my Father and love people and give freely what I found and come join us. That's what this thing is. I haven't done anything. I wish I could tell you how much I could impress that upon you. But I haven't done or accomplished or tried to do anything but just sit around here and copy you. And the miracles that fill my life are countless by the name. I've got it all because I ain't trying to get nothing. When I tried to get it in my 67th year, I couldn't get it. When I quit trying to get it, I got it all. I ain't trying to go anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous. I ain't trying to be nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I quit trying to go anywhere or be anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been all over the world. All I've ever done is when you say, "Here you are," I say, "Okay." And I love you more than anything in the world. You're the reason that I am. You're the evidence that I can be. You're the reflection of what I will be or won't be. And that's why I love you. I don't love you for what you are. I love you for what I am when I'm with you. If I don't ever do anything else in the world, at least once upon a time, a long, long time ago, in my lifetime, I was given the opportunity come to Niagara Falls, Ontario, Canada, and thank you for my life. And try to tell you, express to you how much I love you and how grateful I am that you came for me. I know gratitude is a thing that bandies around in Alcoholics Anonymous very easily. And I don't know much about it, other than the fact that it isn't something you say, it's an action that you take. I know that. Somebody that I loved a long time ago was in a deep coma in a hospital. Mary was her name, and she was my mother. Not mother who bore me, my mother. There's a difference. There's a difference between hatching them and raising them. My mother raised me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name was Myrta Snyder. And I loved her above all things. She taught me to love. She's dying, she's in a deep coma, and I drive down here. It's 100 miles, and I'm trying to figure out what to say to her on the way down here. How am I going to thank her for my life? How do you think? How do you look at her and say, thank you for what you've given me? You've given me everything I got. And I'm sitting there at the bed, and she's got these things hanging from the wall, and she's in a deep coma, and she's got the thing in her nose and tubes in her, and I'm crying. I don't know what to say. I said, my God, I want to, how do I thank you? And her eyes cleared for an instant, and she said this to me. She said, sweetheart, there's only one way in God's world that you can ever express your gratitude in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's to remain a good example of what this program can do for you. And I hope and pray to God that I always will. Thank you.